From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Florida will play a key role in this year's presidential election, as will the state's growing number of Hispanic and Latino voters. This crucial voting demographic now makes up 17% of Florida's electorate. National labor and Latino advocacy groups launched new voter outreach initiatives in Orlando last week. We'll learn about those efforts as we explore Florida's changing Latino and Hispanic populations and the issues most important to this voting bloc. Plus, the U.S., Mexico, and Cuba are negotiating how to divvy up a 7,700-square-mile portion of the Gulf of Mexico known as the Eastern Gap. Despite an oil drilling moratorium that covers much of the U.S. side of the Eastern Gulf, that has some environmental advocates concerned about potential impacts to Florida of future oil drilling by Cuba. We'll take a closer look at the situation. First, this news. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for being with us. The U.S., Cuban, and Mexican governments began negotiations last month over how to divvy up a 7,700-square-mile portion of the Gulf of Mexico known as the Eastern Gap. Beneath the ocean floor under the Eastern Gap is believed to hold a large amount of oil, but with no clear owner, drilling hasn't been occurring there. Supporters of an oil drilling moratorium that covers much of the U.S. side of the Eastern Gulf worry negotiations over the Eastern Gap could lead to Cuban oil drilling operations just on the other side of the country's maritime border with the U.S. near the Tampa Bay area. Much of Cuba's oil is supplied by Venezuela, but a weak economy there could impact the country's ability to continue supporting Cuba with oil and could prompt Cuban leaders to expand their own oil exploration efforts. For the remainder of the hour, we'll be taking a closer look at international law that governs maritime resources, negotiations over ownership of the Eastern Gulf, and possible impacts to Florida's coastline in the future. Joining me now is Dr. David Guggenheim. He's president and founder of the nonprofit ocean conservation organization Ocean Doctor, as well as an ocean explorer, marine scientist, conservation policy specialist, and educator. He's also the former vice president of the Ocean Conservancy and former president and CEO of the Conservancy of Southwest Florida in Naples and a former co-chair of the Everglades Coalition. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Good to speak with you.
It's great to talk with you again.
We're also joined by Jorge Piñon. He's director of the Latin American and Caribbean Energy Program at the Jackson School of Geosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. He's previously worked in Latin America and Spain as an executive for the Amoco and Shell companies. He's been called upon to testify before federal lawmakers and Texas state lawmakers on issues related to energy policy and Latin America. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, John. A pleasure to be with you.
And I invite listeners to join the conversation as well. Phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Post comments and questions on our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media. Tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live or send email to gulfcoastlive@wgcu.org. And Jorge, I wanted to begin with you. First of all, can you explain to us why this area called the Eastern Gap exists in the first place, and why is ownership of this area still kind of up in the air?
There are two areas in the U.S. Gulf of Mexico, the Western Gap, which is really shared now by the U.S. and Mexico, and then the Eastern Gap, which is shared or is about to be shared by the U.S., Mexico, and Cuba. These are areas that extend over the 200-mile economic exclusive zone. Gotcha. That each country has the right to explore resources within that area. So this is basically defined as maybe a no-man's land in which eventually the countries that potentially has rights over that area can sit down and technically draw maritime or demarcation lines. That process was done on the Western Gap back in the year 2000, and now it's about to happen on the Eastern Gap between Cuba, Mexico, and the U.S.
And why is this, these negotiations, why are they only happening now? Is that related to the, you know, the recently thawed diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba?
Well, these were areas in which maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago, by the way, these are extremely deep water areas.
Okay.
So the technology, both to seismic technology to identify potential oil and gas resources, and most important, the technology to extract those deep water resources was really not around 15, 20 years ago. It is now that we have the seismic technology to identify the resource and, of course, the technology also to produce at ultra-deep waters of more than 10,000 feet. On the Mexico side, by the way, U.S. companies are already drilling on the U.S. side, and Mexico is about to open a new concessionary term here in December. So we're going to see for the first time international oil companies drilling on the Mexican side of the Western Gap. So we already see activity on the other end of the Gulf of Mexico, and I think that's why now there is momentum to at least agree on the demarcation line for the Eastern Gap.
How do you anticipate those demarcation lines being drawn? How will this area be divvied up? Will the U.S. get the lion's share?
Yes. By the way, it is a technical agreement. From a political point of view or even legal point of view, it's very transparent. It's more technical than anything else. It's a tedious process, but again, it's very transparent and very clear to come up with those lines. Most likely, the U.S. will end up with about 70% of the area, Mexico 20%, and then Cuba will get a wedge, the southern wedge in the gap, which is about 10%, as you mentioned, of the total 7,700 square mile area.
Do you anticipate these negotiations being a lengthy process, or do you anticipate, you know, these demarcation lines will be, you know, drawn and settled relatively soon?
I don't think it's going to be an extremely lengthy process unless you really mix politics into it. As I say, from a technical point of view, it should be easy. Leave the politicians or at least the politics out of it. And I would assume that within 9 to 12 months, we might very well see an agreement on the demarcation of the Eastern Gap.
And once that is settled with the Eastern Gap, how soon after that do you anticipate, you know, seeing some kind of oil drilling operations there?
Well, remember, this is the first step of what is going to be a very long process before we see any seismic exploratory activity.
Gotcha.
Remember that the Eastern Gap is an area that really has not been explored. So geologists have an idea of what the potential undiscovered reserves are. According to the API, to the American Petroleum Institute, it could be as much as a billion barrels of oil. But the first thing that we have to do is seismic exploratory work, and that's going to take a number of years. Once the seismic work identifies potential reservoirs, then you're going to see what is going to become a very contentious issue, which is actually exploratory drilling, where you actually start drilling into those reservoirs to make sure that those reserves are there. That, again, to me, is still a long term, maybe 3, 5, 7 years. Remember that at today's oil prices, it's not even economic to drill an exploratory well. An exploratory well in the Gulf of Mexico is anywhere between $100 to $150 million. And $50 a barrel do not provide the monetary resource to produce those barrels. So still it's going to be a while.
All right. And You know, with the Eastern Gap being, you know, hundreds of miles from U.S. coastline, you know, outside of the exclusive economic zone, why is there this concern about potential impacts to U.S. coastline from these negotiations?
Well, first of all, there's no oil company that is going to drill in an area
right.
in which the boundaries between host countries is not clear. So for the first time, what this is going to allow is that it's going to allow international oil companies to drill, well, to do seismic work and to drill at least on the Mexican side and most likely also on the U.S. side on the Central Planning District. Now, one of the important things from this conversation is that the gap, a portion of the gap is on the western side of the moratorium area. As you know, there is a moratorium until the year 2022 in which there can be no drilling. A big portion of the gap is within that moratorium area, but there is a portion of the gap that is outside of that area that both Mexico, the U.S., and Cuba could start seismic work and eventually exploratory drilling before 2022. And that could very well be the mechanism by which, if oil is found, could then put pressure, political pressure, on the U.S. lifting the moratorium on the eastern on the eastern side of the Gulf of Mexico.
And do you know if the Cuban government has expressed interest in ramping up its own oil production in Cuban waters and you know, taking steps toward becoming more energy independent? Wouldn't that be a net gain for the country's economy?
They tried that in 2012, uh-huh. and there were three exploratory wells drilled, and those were unsuccessful. Now, those were on the northern Cuba trust belt. These are different waters. This is ultra-deep Gulf of Mexico. And yes, Cuban scientists believe, and some U.S. geologists, some of them here at the University of Texas, that there are still considerable reserves to be discovered on the northwest deep water of the Cuban economic zone. But again, as you know, Cuba doesn't have the technology. Cuba would have to attract international oil companies to come and do seismic work and exploratory well in work in that area. And today, there's not a clear demarcation line, so not until that happens and until oil surpasses at least $65, $70 a barrel, I don't believe you're not going to see any activity either on the Cuban side or on the Mexican side.
And Dr. David Guggenheim, you know, that 2012 exploratory well that Jorge just mentioned, you know, and other wells that they've dug, or I'm sorry, not dug, but that they've begun to utilize or tried to utilize, these were just 55, 60 miles off of Florida's coastline. Can you explain kind of what the concern is there in terms of impacts to Florida? Is this primarily related to the loop current?
Of course, there are very strong currents coming up that connect us. In fact, one of the mantras of marine biologists is that the Florida Straits don't separate our countries, they unite them. And, you know, from a biologist's point of view, that's very true. And unfortunately, those same currents that carry fish and larvae between our countries can also carry petroleum. And this is one of the great concerns. These currents can run at 3 or 4 knots. I can remember being anchored in some of these currents and stumbled up from my bunk with a cup of coffee and thought we were underway because our boat was leaving a wake, just standing still in this current. So within a matter of hours, a day or two maximum, you could have, if there were a blowout in Cuban waters, you could have those that oil already reaching the U.S. Shoreline, specifically in the Florida Keys and up the eastern coast of the United States. So that's a grave concern. But what's also interesting is that the currents in the Gulf of Mexico itself are quite dynamic. You have a huge feature called the loop current because it's a giant loop that goes up the western side of the Gulf, then turns east along the Louisiana coast and the Gulf states, and then turns south along the Florida coast. And within that body of water, you have some very complex dynamics as well. And during deep water horizon, the projections, and some may remember those projections, initially threatening the Florida Keys and up the east coast of the U.S., but they also included impacts in Cuba and in Mexico. So we're all very much connected by these currents, and each of our countries can be potentially a threat to the other.
I was looking back at an NPR story from several years ago, and you were quoted regarding, you know, modeling studies we can point to that predict how much oil from a spill from a Cuban drilling operation could end up in U.S. waters, and it was something like 90%.
That was the estimate that was done by on the Cuban side.
Uh-huh.
Sorry about the background noise. That was an estimate done on the Cuban side. Looking initially at their, when they were initially talking about the drilling for oil down there, and they projected that roughly 90% of the oil from a spill on their northwestern coast would end up in U.S. waters, and specifically, again, through the Florida Keys and up the eastern coast of Florida. And unfortunately, these are waters that are filled with coral reefs. And coral reefs, we know already, are among the most sensitive of the animals in the ocean. They don't like the temperature too hot or too cold. They don't like the salinity, except in a very narrow range. And we've lost roughly half of the corals in the Caribbean in the past 50 years. And we're on track to continue to lose them. And, of course, in the Keys, the situation has been even worse. We've lost a lot of coral. So adding an oil spill to all this is a very magnified concern when you're considering coral reefs and, of course, how important they are, not just to the biology, but also to the economy.
And I know through Ocean Doctors, Cuba Conservancy Program, or you've been involved in a research in coral there. And from what I've heard from other researchers as well, is that the health of corals Cuba is much better than what we have along the coast of Florida. Why do you think that is?
I've described it as a living time machine. It's like going back in time to when I was a teenager exploring the Florida Keys in the early 70s. And in fact, it was better in some places. It's not uniform throughout Cuba, but many, and I would say most, of Cuba's coral reefs are much healthier. And of course, Cuba has developed far differently than any other place in the Caribbean. They have only recently, in the last couple of decades, even been open for tourism, and certainly not at the scale as in other countries. They haven't had nearly the level of coastal development and destruction of mangroves and wetlands that we've seen in the rest of the Caribbean and in Florida, unfortunately. They also have very strong environmental laws. They've protected 25% of their coastal waters in marine protected areas. Much of that is no take, meaning no fishing, no extraction of any kind. And while even, you know, unfortunately a small percentage of that is actively enforced right now, it's still a respectable world-leading figure. In comparison, the United States is up to maybe 10%, and the world average is only 2%. So I think it's a combination of all of these factors, and for the first time gave me a lot of hope, going to see these beautiful, healthy coral reef ecosystems full of sharks and grouper and species I have, you know, these days that we feel very lucky to see, seeing them in numbers. And it tells me that if we can do right by our coral reefs and implement good protection policies and don't repeat the mistakes that we've made throughout the Caribbean, we can bring them back.
Several months back, I was speaking with a scientist with Moat Marine Laboratory out of Sarasota, and they had traveled to Cuba late in 2015 with plans to go back, I think, sometime this year again, you know, studying coral and just very excited to be able to have this kind of access that before the improved diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Cuba, they just simply didn't have access to. But your Cuba Conservancy Program has been going on for something like 15 years now. Isn't that correct?
That's right. Almost since I left Southwest Florida and came to Washington, D.C., I've been commuting down to Cuba and doing this work, and it is like a living laboratory. Fortunately, even with the economic embargo, which, of course, is still in place, even with the restoration of diplomatic relations and all of the travel restrictions that go with the economic embargo, scientific research has always been a permitted activity. So even with the before the restoration of relations, we were able to travel freely, although quite, you know, with complications all the time. It's become much easier now, but fortunately, scientific research has always been recognized as a needed activity, even when political relations were terrible.
And I understand your research in Cuba also involves sea turtles. Can you tell us a bit about that? Would they perhaps be the very same sea turtles that, you know, you would spot along Cuban waters as you would along Florida's coastline at different times of the year?
Well, you know, sea turtles are one of these species that truly connect our countries. And there's evidence that sea turtles that nest in Cuba forage in U.S. waters and vice versa. And a number of years ago, we worked to put satellite tags on sea turtles to track their migrations. And strangely, all the ones with Cuban names stayed in Cuba. Science hasn't been able to explain that yet. But the other ones, one went up into just about to U.S. waters. One went way down to Nicaragua, went out over to Cancun to hang out for a while. But I think it just underscores the point that these are species that we all share, and we have to work together in collaboration to truly understand how migratory species like turtles, like whales, like sharks, you know, how they function, what they need, and what the conservation implications are. And then again, we have to work together to protect these beautiful species that we all treasure so much.
All right, so collaboration is key. Well, that is all the time we have for today's show, but thanks so much to my guests. We've been speaking with Dr. David Guggenheim, president and founder of the nonprofit ocean conservation organization Ocean Doctor, as well as an ocean explorer, marine scientist, conservation policy specialist, and educator. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Also, thanks to Jorge Piñon, director of the Latin American and Caribbean Energy Program at the Jackson School of Geosciences at the University of Texas at Austin. Great to speak with you today as well.
Thank you, John.
There's more information on today's show and past editions of the program online at wgcu.org/Gulf Coast Live. Continue the conversation on Facebook at WGCU Public Media and on Twitter using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. Thanks to my producers Richard Chinqui, AJ Leonard, and Tara Halligan. This is WGCU FM, Fort Myers 90.1, WMKO Marco Island 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.